You're listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to another edition of La Hora del Ruido. My name is Jose Podrido, and you are listening to CKUT 90.3. Today, I'm going to be playing a quick set list of new releases that I came across lately. The first song comes out of a demo from a band from Indonesia called Ox. This song is called Metode Adiksi.
We'll be right back.
Back at La Hora del Ruido, you are listening to CKUT 90.3. We just heard a band from Indonesia called Social Illegal with a song called No Border. Before that, we heard No Fucker with a song titled They Call It Peace. Before that, we heard Logan's Paradise from a Swedish band called Critic. Before that, we heard a band called Chalk with a song called The Abyss. And we started the set list with Ox from Indonesia called Metode Adiksi.
There's a lot going on in the world today. See how it affects Montreal's Black and Caribbean community. Read the community contact. News, features, opinions, music reviews, cultural events, and so much more. Our voices, our perspectives, our community. Published every 2 weeks, pick it up at your favorite community spot or visit us online at our new and dynamic website, mtlcommunitycontact.com. Easy to navigate and lots to enjoy. Archived issues also on the site and available on the web. That's mtlcommunitycontact.com. Stay in contact.
And that's it for me for today. I'm going to lead you with Boris, who's next. Boris?
Hello, everybody. This is La Hora del Ruido, presented by Noise Not Borders at CKUT 90.3 FM in Jaurjague, Montreal. I'm Boris, and I am going to program this next couple of tracks for you. I hope you enjoy it all. I'm going to start things out with Pinyen from Catalunya, Spain, with the track Nicolás Aquintreman from the Nicolás Aquintreman EP that was out on 2022, followed by Abyssum with the track Sangre. They're from New York City, followed up by Ilusión from Montreal with the track Saturn Bliss from their self-titled tape. This is from this year as well. And last, it's going to be Toscos from Santa Ana, California, the track Presos from their new album Infernal that was just out last week, I think. I hope you enjoy it all. Thank you.
Dinchen na pum lalo kaya dinchen na lina lang ka kita na pum entong pa ni chumme chan na ka kita man chumme chan me inche mun tuma no bilu kita man kita man mun tuma bili dal ka tu no ben man inche ta mun tu bali mu bali ya bi yang ka ke ra so bi yang ka gai mu ta inche kita man ka uri ya wai gai ka pum inche entong pa lu ba kita na pum nyu ke ma pum mun tuma ngan bi yang no ben tila gai ta ti amu tu ya
We'll be right back. Psychoanalysis and Superheroines, an interview with Lacanian psychoanalyst Hilda Fernandez Alvarez.
The most successful vehicle for ideology is the image of the superheroes.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
My name is Hilda Fernandez. I'm a founder member of the Lacan Salon, and I'm a psychoanalyst in private practice, and I work for Vancouver Coastal Health as a psychotherapist.
Could you just say what the Lacan Salon is?
Yes, the Lacan Salon is a study group that started in September 2007, comprised of academics, grad students, activists, artists that are interested in studying the theories of Sigmund Freud and Jacques Lacan. We do this every other Tuesday, and there's a lot of dialogue and creative discussion among all the different people interested. We have geographers, we have people from literature, we have philosophers, we have a mathematician. We have clinicians, so it's a space of inter-dialogue between different disciplines. We have artists, of course, so it's a very neat space.
Sounds like fun. Can you say also who Lacan was, since everybody knows who Freud was, at least a little?
That's right, yeah. Jacques Lacan was a psychoanalyst from France that took back the main theories of Sigmund Freud and incorporated new disciplines or new discourses to make it, more modern. He takes a lot of philosophy, he takes a lot of linguistics, he takes some mathematics to explain how the unconscious works in language and in actions.
All right, so superheroines, do superheroes and superheroines even have an unconscious?
That's a good question, but what is important is that the viewers are those that have the unconscious, and that with our fantasies we engage with what is depicted in their personalities, because there's a lot of different elements that attract us from superheroes and superheroines. The way they look, right? They look very athletic, very attractive. They display their beauty in costumes that are full of symbolism. Their secret identities bring mystery, and their special powers are fascinating. And also, they usually have a vulnerability. So we get really interested in how, I am very interested in how we unconsciously might be identifying and putting there some of our ideas and our fantasies.
Can you give me an example of sort of a human and then the superheroine that person would be interested in and why?
Mm-hmm. For example, let's say Wonder Woman, who has been around since the 1940s, and she has had a lot of different retcons or rebooting in her story, in her narrative. I think that the way she's depicted is like an independent, a strong woman, that someone might find some inspiration in her, or the way she goes about solving situations. So you can relate to her in that way, or you can see things that you would like to do, but you are unable to do, such as have the power of protecting or defending, right? And that can be a way of connecting with Wonder Woman, for example.
Well, let's go into Wonder Woman a little bit more, because it happens that when I was a girl, she was quite a favorite of mine. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that she's been rebooted a few times. But let's start with the Wonder Woman. Maybe the most recent Wonder Woman was, what, the Linda Carter Wonder Woman?
Mm-hmm.
So what was different about her powers to protect? What did she do?
Well, she has some different powers, right? She's a very good athlete and a very good Amazon. She comes from Paradise Island, right? It's her homeland. which is based on the Greek Amazons, which was a tribe of female warriors that they were very good with the bow. So the bow.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so she has a combination, as I was saying, of her athletic abilities. But also she has some gadgets, such as the lasso of truth, which everybody that is hooked into her lasso, they have to tell the truth. But you know,
what a wonderful power, eh?
I know.
Journalists need that.
And you know what? Something very interesting is that the man who created the character of Wonder Woman, which is Dr. William Marston, he was a psychologist that was an inventor of the lie detector. So the lasso of truth, this gadget that this Wonder Woman has, it was inspired in a way by this other creation that he's produced, right?
Yes. Oh, and another thing about Wonder Woman, you don't see her shooting, but she can deflect bullets with her wristbands, right? I mean, it's a very defensive thing as opposed to an offensive thing.
Exactly, because the whole kind of depiction or the way the creator, Dr. Marston, was that she was against violence. So she could use more like defensive than aggressive, right? And she has this pair of bracelets that were her shield. And she has her invisible airplane as well.
Mm. Was she invisible when she was in the airplane? Or just you could see her flying through the air without any visible means of support?
I never saw actually a TV show with her in the airplane, but in the cartoons, in the comics, I think you could see her.
Before we leave Wonder Woman, I'd like to go back a little bit to the Paradise Island, because it was a society of women, and she had a wise, was that her mother, this wise mentor figure?
Yes, there was a tribe of only women in that island, and then there was this the male character that arrived, but apparently it was a very harmonious island. But you know, something interesting is that there was a man that was a critic of all sorts of comics, and he made some very harsh critiques on Wonder Woman in a very prudish way, saying that his book was called The Seduction of the Innocent, so you can imagine. So he was criticizing Wonder Woman as the lesbian counterpart of Superman, and also that she was showing an appeal to male fantasies of sexual domination. So, that's like, who thought about that if he didn't, right? Like, his lens was very judgmental and very prudish, right? Like,
but tells a lot about him. I guess, you know, if you had him, you were psychoanalyzing him from that, you'd have something to work with.
Exactly. It's the way it works, right? They are characters that depict some social and political things that in society, and then the audience, the viewer, really engages with his own unconscious, right, to project discourse.
So now, I saw in the press release that you said Batgirl was your favorite cartoon or heroine, superheroine, and that you were going to wear a Batgirl costume to an event where you're appearing.
Yes, I'm donning the Batgirl costume in my own interpretation, obviously. I was looking for a nice costume, and well, I kind of made it my own. Yeah, I really like Batgirl when I was growing up. It was, it was a wonderful woman for me, right? The way she talked, the way she moved, she seemed very confident, very powerful, very gracious. The actress that gave life to that Batgirl of the 1960s, I got to know her in the shows that were very lately arriving to Mexico at that time in the late 70s. And I was just fascinated by her whole graciousness. And she was a dancer, the actress, so she could do a lot of little leaps, and I was just admiring her confidence and her graciousness in light of danger.
What were her superpowers?
That's a very important question, because there's a big division that I do to understand superheroes. Some are, let's say, they have alien powers that were really produced by chemical reactions, such as in Spider-Man, or they come from somewhere else like Superman. Or they are the technocrats, as I call them, that they really profit from technologies. They really incorporate lots of training. And Batgirl is in the technocrats' side because she doesn't have a special power, but she has her belt with all sorts of gadgets that can help in kind of dangerous situations. And she's a very good fighter as well in the comics as well as in the TV shows.
So you've seen Batgirl comics as well. Are they still being produced?
Well, you know, one of the reboots, or retcon, as they call, of Batgirl, is that in one of the comics, she was attacked by the Joker, and she was left paraplegic. So she was really, it's kind of a very, I was really disappointed with that, like really hurt by that writing option. I mean, kind of that creative, or rather destructive kind of measure towards her. But then she was recovered in 2006 by one female writer. And then Batgirl was Oracle at that time, and she was a paraplegic, but she became a super genius of the computer. So she could help a lot of people, or fighting the crime through her abilities with the computer. So it is still produced, but is a different Batgirl. It's the same Batgirl, but in a different role, in a different time, right? And that's interesting to see how the depiction of women have evolved with time, right? With the social and, political.
So from being a gracious and graceful person, she went to being disabled but highly intellectual. And this is, I mean, you think that's kind of a sign of the times?
I think in terms of the incorporation of the technology and the use of the computer, yes. But one cannot but ask why was necessary to leave her disabled, right? When I say also the depiction is that more and more, for example, in the X-Men, there's the need of incorporating more ethnically diverse teams, right? There's a more equal power between superheroes and men and women. So there's some reflection there. For example, same in the X-Men, there was a wedding of a gay couple. For example, Batwoman, which was a different character, and it was before Batgirl, but she was remade retconned later in the 2008, something like that. She became like the same Batwoman, but she was of Jewish origin, and she was homosexual. So there's some sort of incorporation of new kind of sexualities, or new ways of expressing your sexuality, rather, into the discourse of the comics, into the narratives, right? They permeate to that level.
On Wings, you're listening to an interview with Lacanian psychoanalyst Hilda Fernandez-Alvarez. She talked with Frieda Worden about superheroines and psychoanalysis in 2014. According to a 2023 story in Esquire, a new Batgirl film has been ashcanned before it was quite finished. Sources in Warner Brothers and DC reportedly described it as unspeakable and bad for DC's image. They decided it would be better to take a tax write-off on the $90 million project than to release it on HBO or in theaters. Little has been revealed about what they found wrong with the movie that would render it unfit for either the large or small screen. But reportedly, Batgirl's sidekick is trans. So are there any new superheroines?
I was doing my research based on women superheroes, and each decade has produced a lot of difference. In the 70s, there was, for example, one really, really kind of very activist feminist, Valkyrie, who was a chemist student that was ignored by her teacher in her scientific pursuits. So she was working really hard. She sleeps in the lab. And then after some spill, she has gained some fantastic strength. And she goes out to kick all the bad guys. So, yeah, every decade has presented with a different type of new heroines, right? And new super powerful women. But, yeah, the question that I want to ask at the end of this exploration of women in these type of depictions is how we establish sexual differentiation. Because always when we talk about women superheroes, or powerful women to that matter, it's always in relationship of how they are depicted, right? How they are depicted in the stories, how they are treated in power. So I want to establish a little bit that this discussion about sexual difference and how we go about to establish that.
So what kinds of theories are you coming up with around that?
Well, I kind of want to express what is the Lacanian psychoanalysis about in terms of the sexual differentiation. There's a lot of critique from, for example, feminists about the phallocentric, right? Because it's about the phallus. But many times the phallus as a theoretical construct pair as the sexual organ for men. But in reality, the phallus, nobody has the phallus. It's just the signifier. It's a word that is loaded with a lot of power, right? A lot of imaginary power. And I want to explore how we position differently in regards of these signifier called the phallus. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. March the 6th, we are going to be four people. I mean, I'm a psychoanalyst, but there's a geographer, Paul Kingsbury, that is going to be talking about the anger management of Hulk. problems of the Hulk. And then there's going to be Dan Adelman, who's going to talk about Superman and the recent movie. And there's another colleague, Dr. Larry Green, who is going to talk about how Sin City characters and that type of diehard characters are depicted as superheroes when in reality they are traumatized. They are suffering from PTSD. So it's going to be a very diverse panel.
Oh, yeah.
It's going to be recorded and available to everyone to see it online. So,
doctor, should I call you doctor?
No, Hilda. I have two master's degrees, one in clinical psychology, one in literature by UBC. And my training in Lacanian psychoanalysis has been independent with different seminars and my own analysis, supervision. It is a never-ending formation. I continue reading and working and researching. So, you can call me Hilda.
Okay. So, Hilda, how do you go about doing research in psychoanalysis?
Well, the research in psychoanalysis, I would say the first subject to that research is yourself. And that's the most important thing about psychoanalysis, that it's always something that is about yourself. It's a little bit like philosophy. When you read theory, it's about yourself. And that's important because that establishes a relationship to knowledge and truth very differently than thinking about the object of study somewhere else. So that gives you a very, very meaningful theory because it's about yourself. But that doesn't mean that it's a self-absorbed or narcissistic or only about yourself. It is understanding yourself that you become more cognizant of what is happening in the world. It is when you can tell things about yourself that you perhaps can see better what is happening out there and engage in a different level in terms of your desire, right? In terms of society, in terms of the things that motivate you to leave, right?
Mm. So when you're researching Batgirl, you are remembering what your feelings were about Batgirl as a child, and you see how you developed, and then you work out an analysis from that?
Yeah, I would say for what I did in this case is kind of look at myself and said, okay, the idea of the superheroes came in a conversation with Amjo Hall, a good friend that organizes a lot of events in the community engagement office at Woodward's SFU. So it came after a conversation about superheroes and wouldn't it be good to have some discussion about how they are in their psychics, in their psychologies. And then I started to think right away, following that line of self-research, what has been for me to relate to superheroes. So I immediately came with Batgirl and how it was a model, an ideal for me when I was little, and then how that relationship that I created can be, in a way, a model of how we relate in general to superheroes. So first of all is kind of understanding how in me has been this relationship and what of that relationship I want to talk about, and then bring it to the social, in a more social research, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. In this case, it's kind of a reflection on aesthetics and the social and the culture and the political, right? Because also the superheroes are the best vehicle for ideological, communication, right? We can really relate to them and be totally brainwashed if the creators want to, right?
Well, certainly they can suggest stories, and then the stories have an effect. Yeah, I mean, I would think. But when you spoke about it being political, I remember not too many years ago going to a Batman movie, and the villain was Catwoman, and Catwoman was an environmentalist. And I thought, ooh, this has a very right-wing subtext or anti-environmental subtext. I don't like this movie. So do you see that kind of thing?
Absolutely, absolutely. That's exactly what I was referring by being the most successful vehicle for ideology is the image of the superheroes. Because, yeah, we love them and that kind of thing. But obviously there's a critical mass, hopefully, that can see those things. We salute Batman, turn ultra-right against what resemble in time and space the occupied movement, right? Or what you were saying, like just repressing those that are manifesting against the establishment, right? So it's the same with, for example, the other movie, Iron Man, that Iron Man is attacking the supposed terrorists in the Middle East, and we forget that he himself is a warlord. He has all his money coming from the wars, right? And so there's a lot of layers that are there that if there's no critical mass, well, they just pass as superheroes. But there's the possibility of reading into what is the message ideologically there, right?
So what about left-wing political ideology in superheroes and heroines? Do you see any of that?
Well, that's a little vacant. Yeah, you know that the feature of the superhero in a way is might be aligning with the right. Unfortunately, many times the villains or those that are, for example, Catwoman was more not really a bad person, but she was a theft. But she could be a little bit more edgy. And the fact that the superheroes are into this kind of more strict way of seeing the good and the bad and this mannequin position, this bipolarity of the good and the bad, might be conducive to position them in the law and order, and therefore the repression, right? So there's an element there of,
because violence is so easy to depict as a solution.
exactly.
So what, wonder if it would be possible to have a superhero or superheroine who is like dialogue woman or something like that.
Yeah, and what then could be the power there, the ability to negotiate, to erase their own narcissism in good faith of something that can happen from a community-based thing. That could be wonderful.
Yeah, well, it might not have quite the gut impact of a car chase or something.
That's right. That doesn't have the because, you know, in Lacanian psychoanalysis, there are three levels of reading any phenomena. It's the imaginary, the symbolic, and the real. The imaginary is all the physics of the superheroes, for example. The thing that we see in the surface, we see as a mirror, right? It has to do with the looks. It has to do with the image in general. But there's the symbolic, has to do with the dialogue, with what is a little bit of the substance. What is the narratives? What are the stories, right? The histories there, and the real is something that is outside of what we can speak, right? So a lot of what happens with the superheroes is that they stay very much in the imaginary, which is, I mean, in terms of psychoanalysis, could be one of the most surface level, right? One most banal level.
But still, you think that, I mean, can it be therapeutic to engage with them?
Absolutely. We need our imaginary as well, right, for functioning. I mean, there's that interdependence of the three registers. But yes, yeah, it still is therapeutic. It still can be a way of perhaps solving some, not necessarily solving, I could say airing some issues, right, through that image.
Yes. So, Hilda Fernandez, we've reached the end of our time, and I much appreciate your being a guest. And is there any last thing you'd like to comment before we close?
Yes, that something very important is to ask ourselves the question of how we can empower ourselves, right? Rather than just looking at the superpowers, what I can do to reach my potential, to reach my possibility within my own desire in how I want to live my life. So that's a question that we should ask ourselves.
So we don't have to have superpowers to be strong and to deal with the world.
Exactly.
Vancouver-based psychoanalyst Hilda Fernandez is co-founder of the Lacan Salon. I interviewed her in March 2014 for CJSF-FM's International Women's Day coverage. The editor was Annie Roach of Arts Edge. As of 2024, Hilda now has a doctorate and has been practicing as a psychoanalyst in Mexico and Canada for more than 25 years. She is now co-president of the Lacan Salon. To hear this and other Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. Special thanks to your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of 36 Steps Toward a Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service. Global Gag Rule. As of 2023, the Republican-dominated U.S. House of Representatives has refused to sign off on the normal 5-year reauthorization of U.S. funds for treatment and prevention of HIV/AIDS around the world. a program initiated by Republican President George Bush in 2003. They will support just a one-year reauthorization, and only if it includes enforcement of the Global Gag Rule. What is the Global Gag Rule? From the Wings Archives, here's your answer, recorded in 2018 when the Trump administration was heavily enforcing the rule.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world. Produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
The United States is far the largest donor of foreign health care aid in the world. Even after recent cuts, it still gives almost $9 billion a year, with more than $600 million committed for family planning. But
it is U.S. government policies that mostly limit the reproductive options of women around the world, whether it's through the Global Gag Rule, where U.S. funds cannot be used to support organizations that either provide abortions or even tell people that abortions are available. And it's really not recognizing that in many of these countries and in these communities, there's only one healthcare center. There isn't a healthcare center for when you're pregnant and a different healthcare center for when you have AIDS and a different healthcare center for when you're a teenager. If they're lucky, they've got one healthcare center. And so if the U.S. withdraws funds from that healthcare center, then they're condemning all the women who got those healthcare services, whatever their needs, to pain, suffering, and death.
That was Loretta Ross, co-author of the 2017 book Reproductive Justice, An Introduction. For most of this program, you'll be hearing a report by Diana Wanyonyi from Kenya. She originally titled it Trump's Global Gag Rule, because one of the U.S. president's first acts was to reinstate and expand an executive order originated in 1984 by President Reagan. Critics called it the Global Gag Rule. It said foreign non-governmental organizations that accepted U.S. family planning aid could not use even money from other sources to counsel about abortion, refer for abortions, or advocate for legalizing abortion laws. Democratic presidents since then have made a show of removing the gag order, and Republican presidents made a show of putting it back. But the real roots of this policy are in a bill passed by the U.S. Congress in 1973, right after the U.S. Supreme Court legalized abortion. This Helms Amendment to the Foreign Assistance Act denies all funding for equipment or services related to abortion. It has never been repealed. The U.S. Agency for International Development opposed the act when it was proposed on grounds it would interfere with countries' ability to provide integrated reproductive health services. Kenya's experience is an example of that. During the time that Hillary Clinton was U.S. Secretary of State, Kenya developed new integrated reproductive health guidelines that included abortion care. But in 2013, after Clinton was replaced by John Kerry, USAID brought pressure to bear on Kenya, and the new guidelines were withdrawn. Then, in 2017, Trump decreed the gag rule would apply not only to the $608 million budgeted for family planning, but to all $8.8 billion of U.S. global health assistance. Diana Wanyonyi is Wings reporter in Kenya.
Kenya is feeling the effects of the global gag rule. It is not well for children, women, and young girls who depend on foreign NGOs receiving U.S. government health assistance for family planning, maternal and child health, nutrition, HIV and AIDS, infectious diseases, malaria, tuberculosis, and neglected tropical diseases. Caroline Nyandati, Reproductive Health Coordinator at Kisumu Medical and Education Trust, says that many clinics and health facilities are lacking commodities and integrated services.
Currently, facilities haven't received commodities for the last 1 year. Providers now do not provide that integrated package that we had advocated for at KIMET. Because services are not being offered as integrated as before, there are issues of cost. Example, there was a facility that was charging $3 to access cervical cancer service. Immunization, they have to pay $2. family planning, they have to pay about $5. So if you add that, a woman can't afford, and they would rather not access the services. But in the integrated model, maybe a woman would only pay $2 and would get entire package. We are more on providing that integrated package.
Non-governmental organizations are now required to agree to the global gag rule as a condition of receiving assistance from the U.S. government. According to the policy, providers must agree not to provide information, referrals, or services for legal abortion or to advocate for the legalization of the procedure.
Kenya actually launched a confidential inquiry about maternal deaths, where we had about 365 maternal deaths, per 100,000 in Kenya. Most of the deaths were because of the big five that we know in Kenya as hemorrhage, sepsis, obstructed labor, hypertensive conditions, and of course, unsafe abortion.
In Ethiopia, adolescents and youth and people living with HIV and AIDS and sex workers are directly affected by the closure of the previously U.S.-supported health clinics.
Close to 1 million women will no longer have access.
Derejo Wondimu, the Policy and Community Mobilization Advisor at IPAS in Ethiopia.
It is expected that 20,000 unintended pregnancy per annum, 20 maternal deaths per annum, 4,000 unsafe abortion is also estimated to this policy.
Suzanne Ehlers is president of Population Action International, or PAI, a global organization advancing the right to affordable, quality contraception and reproductive health care for every woman everywhere. The organization works with the policymakers in Washington and partners in developing countries to remove roadblocks between women and the services and supplies they need. She explains what PAI does in relation to reproductive health.
PAI was started in 1965 by people in the United States who believed that the U.S. government should have a role in partnership with governments around the world to promote development and to advance women's health as a part of that development, believing that for countries to progress and to grow economically and in other ways, you had to secure the health and rights of women and girls. And PAI was founded on that principle and still does that work 55 years later by influencing the U.S. government in its policy and its money, its funding, but also working in partnership with over 65 different organizations in 30 countries, mostly in sub-Saharan Africa, but increasingly we're busy in Latin America, and we're also working in Asia in partnership with partners on the ground who know their governments and who want to work with their governments to improve the health and well-being of their communities by targeting women and girls. We find women who want access to modern contraception and often can't find it or can't find it reliably or are not able to find a diverse array of methods. We find the issue of gender-based violence. We find the issue of early and forced marriage of young girls. We know that unsafe abortion is a problem that is driving maternal mortality rates. So women are dying because they are seeking to terminate a pregnancy and they are not able to do so safely and legally. We know that the health of children under the age of 5, in particular, is directly linked to whether his or her mother has access to contraception. Because if she's able to space her birth, she's able to better care for her current children. And so we see the intersection of nutrition and child health and child survival as it relates to women's ability to control her fertility. Those are the issues that I think are most prevalent for us in Africa.
The gag rule policy is already disrupting services and referral networks, damaging integrated health programs, and diverting resources away from direct service delivery. Ehlers elaborates on its threats.
Any country that's receiving any U.S. money on any health issues now has to contend with the global gag rule. Any African country that's receiving U.S. global health assistance is impacted. It's more than family planning and reproductive health partners. It's any African country that is working with the U.S. government on tuberculosis, HIV and AIDS. Think of the PEPFAR program. The President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief is working in many, many African countries. Anything working on water and sanitation, on malaria efforts, all of that is part of a global health portfolio. So any country that's receiving any U.S. money on any of those issues now has to contend with the global gag rule. Most worrying to me are some of the most trusted service providers in their communities. So I'm thinking of the International Planned Parenthood Federation, and I'm thinking of Marie Stopes International. I'm thinking of groups that are working throughout the world in providing the most basic health care to women and their families. And because they are not in accordance with the global gag rules, limitations and restrictions, I worry that their clinics will close and that in areas where the public sector is not available or is not at capacity to meet the needs of its community, women and their families will suffer. We already saw service providers closing clinics. We saw that the rates of unintended pregnancy were going up. We saw that vulnerable groups like young people, women living in rural areas, women that were living at the lowest levels of poverty were the most impacted and not able to access services. Those communities are already vulnerable, and they were made more vulnerable. With higher rates of unintended pregnancy, recourse to unsafe abortion also increased, driving the rates of maternal mortality in many countries. So that's a sample of some of the things we saw 16 years ago when this policy was in place under President Bush.
On Wings, you're hearing a report from Kenya about effects of the U.S.'s global gag rule. President Trump has reinstated it and even expanded its reach. But as you'll hear, USAID also applied it during the Obama administration. Here's the background. In Kenya, the 2010 Constitution allows abortion to save the life or health of the mother, and its language leaves the door open for further legalization. In 2012, the Ministry of Health published standards and guidelines on reducing maternal mortality and morbidity from unsafe abortion. These were based on World Health Organization criteria. The ministry also issued a curriculum for training mid-level providers, like midwives and nurses, in how to perform legal abortions and give life-saving post-abortion care. The Obama administration had formally repealed the global gag rule, but in December 2013, USAID ordered its aid recipients not to attend a maternal health meeting because safe abortion guidelines were on the agenda. Kenya soon withdrew the guidelines, leaving old, vague guidelines in place. Carolyn Nyandati is the reproductive health coordinator at Kisumu Medical and Education Trust.
The integrated package that facilities provide, they provide within the law. So we usually use our constitution as our book of reference because apparently in Kenya, for the providers, we expected them to be using a standards and guideline. The Kenyan standards and guideline were withdrawn. It was from 2012, so it was supposed to be disseminated, but it was withdrawn. And so providers are using the PAC post-abortion care manual as their reference, as opposed to the standards and guideline that was supposed to reduce incidences of unsafe abortions. So KIMET implements through three levels. We target the community, the facility, and now at policy level. We engage communities in community discussions or conversations. They're able to discuss their needs, and we link them to the facility. And so at the facility, KIMET has managed to train providers. We have actually trained over 2,000 providers on provision of integrated maternal health service provision, where we look at the holistic approach, the mother, the child, the man, the youth. The providers are also taken through some of the policy issues that we have in place, so they are aware of at what context are they providing the services and how. We have created a network of where we look at the legal compliance and also quality service provision, and we are able to give them that technical assistance when they need it from us. In relation to the global gag rule, that has impacted on KIMET at the three levels. For instance, we have now had women or community members having less discussions like they used to have before, where we would actually talk about maternal health needs. They are now more focused on other discussions, like they want to discuss more on security, they want to discuss more on which member of parliament do they want to have on board, as opposed to the health issues that were now more prominent. In the Kenyan system, a community health volunteer is supposed to, one, educate at community level and also provide information for a woman to make a choice to go for a service. And so if there are
You're listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Stay tuned.
Kids without chores and a glass without the pause. A world without laws, a model with no flaws. A tiger with no claws, lumberjack with no saw. A three with no four, a king with no course. Some coke with no snort, you buy it but can't afford. A house with no roof, the truth with no proof. A mouth with no tools, some socks with no shoes. Detective with no clues, it's rap with no blues. A clock with no snooze, a drunk with no booze. A flower with no bees, a snoop with no trees. The beach without a breeze, you planted with no seeds. A preacher who won't preach, no class for you to teach. A seeker who won't see, a dancer with no feet. Got plans but don't lead. A tree with no leaves, big cars but no keys. No blood for you to leave, no heights for you to reach. No games for athletes, no rappers for rap beats. No food for you to eat, in a world with no you with me. I said a world with no you with me. It's crazy, I don't think about how I got there, but what made me? It's gotta make a sense like a drug dealer with babies. It's gotta be 100 like 20 plus 80. It gotta be legit like you ain't try to play me. Like you ain't try to serve me the biscuits without gravy. Like you was all out of